Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello there, history friends. Happy anniversary. What anniversary, you might be thinking? Well, if you just stumbled upon this episode and don't actually realize, today, the 6th of June, 2019, is the 75th anniversary of the D-Day landings. A little while ago, I had an idea. Wouldn't it be cool if we got someone on in time to mark this anniversary who was releasing a book of some kind? And it just so happened that Dr. Peter Caddick Adams was doing exactly that, releasing his book called Sand and Steel, which is the most comprehensive, brilliantly written, researched piece on the D-Day landings that I think exists today. That is quite the claim, but this is really quite the book. And it becomes immediately apparent when you look at the sheer size of the thing. Nearly 1,000 pages long, split almost accidentally, but apparently deliberately, because of how well it reads, between the first half looking at the preparation aspect and the second half looking at all those plans coming to fruition. Sand and Steel is an excellent book, and it really is a privilege to have Peter on this podcast to be able to talk about it. Not only is it a privilege to do that, it is also a super privilege because Peter has offered something pretty cool. He's going to give away one of these very books, and you could be on the receiving end of it. A signed copy of Sand and Steel for all your D-Day needs, now and well into the future. All you have to do to qualify for this book and to enter yourself into this competition is to do, well, one of two things. Either go onto Twitter and retweet the post that I have pinned at the top of my Twitter profile. It'll be fairly clear which status you have to retweet. It'll literally say retweet this to be in with a chance of winning the book. Or go onto Facebook and do the exact same thing by liking, commenting, and sharing that post. You can also do both of those things, so share it over Facebook and Twitter, to be in with an extra opportunity. So this is a great chance for both of us, for myself, and for Peter Caddick Adams, to gain some lovely, juicy publicity around this very opportune time. And he jumped at the chance of providing one of you guys with a book of his. Trust me when I say it is a pretty darn cool reward to receive. I was very excited when mine came in the post, and I have been pretty much glued to it ever since. Even after this interview was finished and I didn't have to prepare for it anymore, I'm still dipping back into it, even though, of course, as is my usual wont, I don't really have the time to do so. Just, of course, to remind you, and I'll remind you again at the end, to go and track down Peter Caddick Adams' book, Sand and Steel. If you don't win the competition, if you do, then that's great. By the way, that competition is running until the 10th of June. So that is Monday the 10th of June, 2019. And I will announce the winner at noon at that day. That is noon GMT, in case you were wondering. So you have a little while to enter, but get in there as quickly as you can, and I will do the rest. I'll pick a name at random, and then I'll let that person know. And if they get back to me in time and give me their address, I'll then let Peter know. And next thing you know, a signed copy of this really great book will be on the way to you. I really can't recommend it enough, guys. Please do check out Sand and Steel by going to Amazon or any of your favourite bookstores. Peter is fortunate in that Penguin Random House is very widely distributed. So, of course, if you go to your local bookshop, which you probably should to support local shopping, etc., etc., I'm sure you'll find it there too. In any case, guys, I don't want to take up any more of your time. So without any further ado, let's get into this very topical and very enjoyable interview between two history friends shooting the breeze about the most incredible Allied act of the Second World War. Happy anniversary and happy listening. Back on the podcast, and my guest today is someone very special, Peter Caddick Adams, and I'm here to talk with him about his wonderful new book on D-Day, Sand and Steel. Welcome on the podcast, Peter.
Zach, it's great to be here, and the day I'm talking to you is actually D-Day, 6th of June 2019, exactly 75 years after all those men strode through the surf and through the skies to get into Normandy.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Very, very apt, I think. It's almost like we did this on purpose. So great to have you on and to be able to talk about your book and to be able to mark the anniversary, as you said. Where are you coming to us from at this moment in time? Because I imagine you're very busy these days.
I'm just outside Portsmouth, which is where I was all yesterday, watching the send-off of veterans crossing the channel on various ships, warships going out, planes flying overhead, including commemorative Spitfires, and everything an echo of how it must have been in Portsmouth on the 5th of June, the sea black with ships, the sky almost completely covered over with aircraft all heading in one direction.
Fascinating, fantastic. Such a brilliant privilege to be able to speak on these things and to meet veterans as well. Did you meet many of them?
Lots. I mean, as soon as I came out of the railway station, there they were, coming off the train, getting onto coaches. I mean, I feel myself in a very privileged position. This all started when I was 14 years old and I went to the Normandy beaches in the summer of 1975. Which gives you my age now straight away, but in those days the veterans were the age I am now, and I was very lucky. The very first time I ever set foot on the sands of Normandy, I met veterans on the sand who were willing to talk, and the first one I spoke to was wearing his kilt, playing his bagpipes, and that was Bill Millin, who was Lord Lovett's personal piper. So that's where the rot set in, if I can put it like that. And ever since then, I've been entranced and captivated. And I really feel I'm the torchbearer. These wonderful people, this great generation, have given me their stories. I've done my best to put them on paper in print, and I'm handing them on to everybody else.
Absolutely. Well, now, in my humble opinion and in the opinion of many others, your latest book is certainly paving the way, is certainly bearing the torch, and it's a very impressive read. My listeners know that I value large books, and this this book certainly fulfills that criteria anyway. So I'm looking forward to talking to you about it.
Me too. As I say, I mean, it may have taken a year to write, and you know the result is huge and weighs a ton. But in a way, it's been 40 years in gestation, so I've had a lot of time to think about it. And I think, I mean, there are many, many people. You can buy many different books out there about D-Day. I think what separates mine, apart from endless eyewitnesses, I've spoken to over 1,000 people who took some role in D-Day or witnessed it either side of the channel, is that I always walk the battlefield terrain. Really walked over every inch of Normandy over the years, sometimes on my own, sometimes with veterans. And it's that eye for the ground really gives you a incredibly deep and comprehensive understanding. And I don't really think you can write any kind of history without walking the ground, whether it's Waterloo, whether it's going up to, I don't know, Manchester and thinking about the Peterloo Massacre. You need to be there where whatever drama happened to reach out and touch the buildings, touch the stone where great events happened. And that then qualifies you to start to write about them because you get a sense of the atmosphere.
Absolutely. It also makes it so much more real as well, because otherwise it just seems like words in a book or images that you see, that kind of thing. I mean, there's nothing like, I still remember when I was there about 10 years ago, being in Auschwitz and seeing it in person. It just, there's nothing quite like being in that place that has taken up so much space in the historical discourse. There's really nothing like it.
And that's where I think, you know, if we're talking in wider terms, some histories stumble. The maps aren't good because they've been copied from someone else's book. And the maps also betray the fact that someone hasn't walked the ground and understood this nuance of high ground or the exact layout of the road network or whatever it is. I mean, walking Omaha Beach, that everyone has done in their minds because they've all seen Saving Private Ryan, you need to go out into the surf and then turn round and stride or run through the surf up onto the sands and towards the beach, because only then do you get a sense of being wet and just how much the beach slows you down. You're at war with nature and terrain, never mind the Germans. And then you stop because, you know, if you replicate the moment you realize you're being shot at and you stop, you look behind you and you can't go back. So you either stand still, which makes you even more of a target, or you somehow overcome your fear and you move forward. And the guys who survive are actually the ones who move forward into the fire. And that is, you know, just overcoming that natural reticence to engage with harm is, you know, the moment you realize that, you suddenly realize how big these men are in their lives. So they can overcome that kind of fear. I mean, they don't have an option, but many just died in the surf.
Yeah, many did. I know you mentioned Saving Private Ryan there, and I think that the first few scenes of that stick with people's minds, because I think when people think of D-Day, if they don't necessarily know it all that well, they think of it as this glorious moment when France was essentially liberated from Nazi Germany. And of course, there's certainly an element of that, but there's also just the sheer brutality and the terrifying spectacle of trying to storm a beach where the enemy is essentially sitting there and looking at you coming and firing all they have in your direction. And I think you capture very well that just as I feel Saving Private Ryan does too.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be wrong to ignore the contributions of Hollywood and other books, because I've taken many people around Normandy, and the questions that I always reference, either the book The Longest Day, which comes out in 1959, the film of 1962, or Saving Private Ryan of much more recent times. And of course, The Longest Day is based on eyewitness accounts that Cornelius Ryan, who an Irishman himself, of course, reporting for the Daily Telegraph at the time, flies over the invasion beaches on the afternoon of D-Day and is so captivated by what he saw that then consumes the rest of his life. And, you know, he spends the next 15 years making interviews and then writes his famous book. So they both, Britt Spielberg and Ryan, both bring aspects of D-Day to life. And they're interlinked because the Saving Private Ryan story about several brothers, or many of whom are killed or posted as missing in action, is based on a real story. But the family are called Niland, N-I-L-A-N-D. And they're an Anglo-Irish family or American-Irish family. But Niland and their sons have sort of Germanic names. Sounds to Germans trying to save Fritz Niland. So Spielberg reaches for the surname of the man who started the whole D-Day business, Cornelius Ryan. And that's where Saving Private Ryan comes from.
That's fascinating. I never knew that. That's a very interesting way to start off our conversation. If I could lob some bit of trivia in your direction, the actual opening scene of Saving Private Ryan is filmed on a beach, Curraghclough Beach in Wexford, which is just about, I'd say, about an hour and a half from where I live right now. And it's to this day still kind of decked out in Saving Private Ryan memorabilia, and still makes a significant amount of tourism and money off that fact.
Is it? I knew it was filmed in Ireland. I knew it was filmed in Wexford. But I had no idea that the beach is still sort of preserved and has become a tourist attraction in its own right. That's absolutely fascinating.
Well, certainly when I was there, the actual pub just up the road from it, it was named in such a way that reminded you of D-Day, something about Normandy or something. When I was there a few
Normandy
years ago.
The Normandy Arms or whatever. Well, I shall have to make it part of my pilgrimage. but it's incredibly important. And I think, you know, to be serious, Saving Private Ryan has made an enormous contribution to our understanding of D-Day. It's really difficult for Hollywood to interpret the reality of the past. And what Spielberg's film does, I think in the first 28 minutes, really, the rest is a story that we can pick holes in and question. But those first 28 minutes really just bring to life the sort of horror of an amphibious landing and the terror. And Spielberg put a great deal of effort into trying to make it realistic. He recorded original weapons being shot at carcasses on ranges, so the sounds were exactly right. And you know, maybe the rest of the film is pales in comparison. But when people say, you know, what was it like? I obviously can't tell people, but from the veterans I've spoken to, they've all reached out and said, that's what I remember. The movie evoked unpleasant memories, and it all came rushing back. And you know, that's the greatest tribute anyone could give to a Hollywood film director.
Absolutely, absolutely. Sure, look, we've jumped right into this, and I haven't even introduced you completely to my listeners. So, Dr. Peter Caddick-Adams, in fact, tell us a little bit about yourself and about your career and everything else, because you have a fascinating history just as a person, in my view.
Well, I didn't go to university when I left school, and I went straight into the British Army, went to Sandhurst, and for the next 35 years, mostly as a reservist, I've worn uniform, and that's taken me to places like Bosnia, in the immediate aftermath of the civil war there, Iraq and Afghanistan. And I volunteered for those because I felt that my sort of civilian job and calling was that of a historian and a military historian. And I really felt that you couldn't write with any credibility without having experienced some of this yourself. So no one's really shot at me in anger, but I've been far away from home with other military people, bunches of strangers thrown together in unpleasant circumstances, you know, and there was plenty of evidence of nastiness in Bosnia all around us and minefields, so it, you know, dangerous terrain, and things like the value of letters from home, things like restrictions on when and where you can drink, and actually alcohol plays very little role in soldiering except on chosen occasions to boost morale or whatever. The camaraderie of strangers in, you know, really surreal circumstances all travels through history. And I firmly believe that, you know, the soldier of today is no different from the soldier who strode through the surf on D-Day, faced musket fire at Waterloo, or was firing off arrows at the French at Agincourt. It's the same person through and through. You're motivated by the same hopes and fears, aspirations, expectations. You wear different clothes. Your weapons and technology particularly are different, but you're the same person through and through. And it's that sense of warriors being the same through history, I think, that enabled me to go back in time to try and bring D-Day alive.
Yeah. And it's a kind of, I suppose, for lack of a better term, a kind of long-running love affair you have with the era, with the act itself. And that I think, definitely shines through in your book, the fact that this isn't just something that you started to research in the last 5 or 10 years even, but something you've been pretty much besotted with for most of your life.
Yes, I wasn't expecting the book to turn out like that. This is certainly not the first book I've written or probed in any depth, but having been to Normandy and spoken to so many veterans, you know, from an early age, it wasn't just meeting a veteran on the sand dunes in August 1975. We went there a little later on for a family holiday. And of course, anyone who's been to Normandy will know that the coast is studded with all these bunkers the Germans built. And in 1975, 1976, you could holiday on the beach, sunbathe. But of course, little me chose to dig the sand out of the bunkers rather than dig sandcastles or swim in the sea.
Yeah.
And, you know, in those days, once you went through several inches of sand, a bit like Troy, once you got down to Troy 5 or Troy 7, there were the cartridge cases from 1944.
Sure.
And that's absolutely mesmerizing when you're that age. So as many of those bullets and cartridge cases came home to England in my schoolboy pockets, and that adds another dimension. I mean, you know, they're not there now, listeners. They've all been removed, and it's a very dangerous thing to do. But this, you know, these are all the jigsaw puzzle pieces that make me the historian I am today. I mean, another little insight: my mother took me to see the movie Battle of Britain, which many people will have seen and may remember seeing, when it came out in 1969, 1970, and it was my 10th birthday. And the point was, she had been 10 when the Battle of Britain was being fought. And so she wanted me not just to understand a bit of history, but also what life had been like for her when she was my age.
Wow.
And of course, you know, the effect was completely beyond her comprehension, because I went back and started making plastic Airfix model Spitfires that hung from my ceiling. So again, you know, this is another piece of the jigsaw puzzle. And if I sort of say Airfix and Humbrol paint and that smell of polystyrene cement, there will be many listeners out there going to nodding their heads sagely, thinking, goodness me, that's a rite of passage I went through too.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So you've really been through the ringer, and I think it gives you like a unique kind of perspective on all of this stuff. And I find it fascinating as well that you transferred career-wise almost from the military to the kind of academia aspect of it. Do you remember always thinking that you wanted to teach, or was it almost just the case that these things kind of happened, like it was a natural progression for you?
There was probably an inkling that I always wanted to write and teach and do a bit of broadcasting. It happened more naturally than that, because I met one of the most inspirational figures, or the most inspirational figure I've ever come across in my life. And you or your listeners may have heard of him. He was a guy, he's no longer with us, sadly, called Professor Richard Holmes. And he devised and created the BBC War Walk series, wrote 30 books in his lifetime on aspects of military history. And he was the Brigadier General in charge of the British Army Reserve. So he was my boss in uniform. But at the same time, he recruited me to the UK Defence Academy, where I lectured for 20 years. So he was twice my boss. He was my professor at the Defence Academy and the officer in charge of the reserves. So when I mobilised to go to war in 2003 in Iraq, I went to him and said, you know, Richard, I'm going to go off to war. And he said, well, I'm upset academically because I don't know how we're going to plug the hole that you will create.
Aww.
But as your brigadier, I'm enormously pleased that you're going off to do the job that we've trained you for.
Yeah.
He said, the brigadier will have to go away and have a conversation with the professor. I'll have to have a conversation with myself. And unfortunately, the brigadier won. But so he was a wonderful guy, incredibly helpful to a whole generation of younger historians. Died far too young about 10 years ago. You know, was well known throughout the world, and particularly the military history sort of fraternity, for really bringing history to the screen and taking it away from what might have been a small coterie of people wearing anoraks, if I can put it like that. He made military history popularly accessible.
Sure.
And it's from people particularly like Richard Holmes that history is offered on so many university curricula now. History used to stop. I was always very angry that when I was studying at school, world history stopped in 1914 and British history stopped in 1939. And we've now gone way beyond that, and there's a whole area of Holocaust studies as well. And Richard was one of the people who made this sort of so accessible. So I always like to tip my hat to him.
Wow.
Because he was one of the individual really who set me on the path to where I am now.
Wow, very interesting. Very interesting. You've mentioned as well, and we keep coming back to it, your experiences, whether it's in Bosnia or in Iraq. And do you find that experience of being mobilized for war almost, do you find that then when it came time to write your book on D-Day, you had this, I suppose, experience of what it felt like to be mobilized, just like they were mobilized 75 years ago? Could you identify with them more, do you think, because of that?
Oh, undoubtedly. Going to Bosnia was a very eye-opening experience, because the terrain was completely blasted. It was full of shell holes. A lot of the buildings had been wrecked. The detritus of war was all around, abandoned helmets, equipment, burnt-out tanks, exactly as Normandy would have been to those landing not in the assault wave but in the follow-up waves. And perhaps more poignantly, when I mobilized for the Gulf in 2003, You sign all the paperwork, and you write your will. That always focuses your mind. And the paperwork included the question, duration of mobilization. And, of course, we had no idea how long this war, this conflict would go on for. And, I mean, no one could think in terms of, you know, the occupation that subsequently happened, the backlash, how it all sort of unwound and went dreadfully wrong in some ways. And when you are putting uniform back on and you're mobilizing to go off on a military operation that has no known duration, no end, that really focuses the mind. And, of course, that's the soldier of 1940 of whatever nationality. You're put into uniform. You can't ask the question, when do I come home? Because no one knows. You come home when the war is over, but no one knows when that's going to be. And, of course, you, in 1940 or whatever year, don't know if you're going to come home at all.
Much like they didn't know. They certainly did not know what they were getting themselves into 75 years ago.
No, exactly. And I'm also struck, and you will have picked this up going through the pages, how many Irishmen took part in the training, the support, and the landings in D-Day. And, you know, that's an eye-opener. Never mind all the Irish who'd emigrated to the United States and were still really first-generation Irish-Americans, who were more than fascinated to come back to their home neck of the woods and mingle amongst their antecedents, as it were.
Yeah, you mentioned mingling there, and I have to say one of the parts of your book which I didn't expect to find so interesting was this, the specter you capture of these about a million Americans suddenly butting heads, for lack of a better term, with the British, whether it was in Northern Ireland or in the south of England, as they prepared for some kind of expedition into France. And I just think the culture shock were like, it was just so fascinating capturing that. Were you surprised coming into this how interested you became in that aspect?
Totally surprised, Zach. And I think that's the wonderful thing about writing history. And if anyone's got any hesitation about putting pen to paper, don't. Because the moment you start diving into a period, you know, the reward is you come up with the unexpected. And I had no idea that it wasn't 1 million Americans who arrived in the United Kingdom during the Second World War. It was 3 million.
Oh, wow.
And the United Kingdom's population then was only 40 million, and a good chunk of them were overseas running the empire, fighting for the empire. Mm. So 4 in 10 of adult males between 18 and 40 were Americans in the British Isles at that sort of time. And, you know, the effect on the population, you know, it was a black and white country, rationed, very austere, very drab, and what happens? The Americans arrive with colour, with peaches, with Spam, with cigarettes and chocolate, all of the sort of things that no one's seen since 1940. They arrive with Glenn Miller and jazz and blues, and, you know, no one's really seen or heard that much before because the BBC are very conservative. So the Americans just sort of liven things up, and I remember, you know, various, particularly the girls around at the time, just sort of said, well, they just livened our life up so much. Yeah. And they left this, you know, lingering memory. And I think, you know, that the special relationship, we keep talking about it. It dates from the Second World War. It doesn't predate it. Mm. We don't have anything in common with the Americans before the war. It's a strange, remote place. We only know of America through Hollywood before the 1940s.
Sure.
And, you know, traditionally, of course, the Brits had backed the wrong side in the Civil War, the Confederacy. And, of course, the Revolutionary War was all about separating from Britain. So Britain and America aren't natural buddies, although we speak the same language. If anything, 1940, there was a great census in the United States, and 20% of Americans identified as being of Germanic origin. That's the largest percentage, not Brit, not Irish, not anywhere else, German.
Wow.
And one of the state parliaments, I think it's Pennsylvania, when deciding what their official language is going to be in the very early days of the United States. The two languages on the state agenda to be adopted as the official language were English and German. And English wins by the casting vote of the speaker.
Wow.
So, you know, everything we take for granted about the United States being paired with the United Kingdom and the two being sort of one and the same or best buddies or first cousins, absolute nonsense. Yeah. And it's time and chance. And so the special relationship, therefore, dates from the Second World War, not before. And it's been through sort of tough times. And really, you know, at the time we're talking now, the 75th anniversary, we take it for granted. And I think what we're doing now is reaffirming it. But we should never take it for granted.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think, would it be fair to say that some of the foundational kind of building blocks of that, the military aspect of that relationship, at least, you go into some good detail in your book on D-Day just about the previous campaigns, such as in North Africa and also in Sicily and into Italy as well. And of course, you have a book yourself on Monte Cassino and a book on the Bulge as well, which would be cool to get into. If we have time, we could go all over the place here. But it wasn't just suddenly D-Day was almost like, I suppose you could call it, in a sense, the culmination of that military relationship, which had been building for a while in the war itself.
Yeah, absolutely. In a way, D-Day is inevitable, and it's become shorthand for the Second World War. Mm. Sooner or later, the moment we've been driven back from Dunkirk in 1940, everybody is aware, and Churchill perhaps foremost and vocalizes it, that we're going to have to return across the Channel and invade France as a way of getting into Germany. I mean, that's the strategic aim. It isn't just to re-invade France. So everybody really is waiting for that opportunity. And the story of between 1940 and 1944 is of the Allies growing as a coalition. America doesn't come in until after Pearl Harbor and Hitler declares war, bizarrely, on the United States at the end of 1941. I mean, you know, there is a sure case for an asylum occupant declaring war in the United States if ever there was. But, you know, the Americans want to rush into invading Europe straight away, and Churchill understands that the Americans are too immature and need to learn how to fight the Germans in battle. And that's what putting the Americans off an invasion in 1942, 1943 is all about. And indeed, they have an early setback in Tunisia at Kasserine, and Patton comes to the rescue. And again, they learn how to fight the Germans in the Sicilian and Italian campaigns, which are incredibly important. And if we remember that D-Day is really a knife edge.
Yeah.
Roosevelt and Churchill's careers would have been over if it had gone wrong. Montgomery and Eisenhower could not have remained in command had the D-Day operations failed. So everything is on a knife edge. And that's because we also know all the previous amphibious operations, major landings we've had, have had problems. The Dieppe raid by the Canadians in 1942 goes horribly wrong, and two-thirds of the invasion force are killed or captured. The Sicily landings and Salerno landings, both in 1943, have not quite failed, but there have been very strong German counterattacks, which almost succeeded. And then Anzio, January 1944, is still in stalemate right through until May 1944, and is certainly an operation that you can't look back on and say, my goodness me, that went well. It didn't. So the Allied track record of amphibious landings in Europe, never mind the fact that Churchill had overseen Gallipoli in 1950. You know, great concept, but poorly executed. So the Allied track record is really mixed, and if anything, pointing towards possible failure. So when we're, you know, about to engage in this in 1944, I think the soldiers would have been fine, but I think at the very top level there's huge nervousness, and we forget that. We take it for granted it's all going to go well because we know it did.
Yeah.
But if you put yourselves in the boots and shoes of those at the time, those senior decision makers, goodness me, they are nervous. Alan Brooke, who's Churchill's Chief of Defence Staff, we would call him today, writes in his diary, my goodness me, by tomorrow morning, 20,000 could be dead. I wish to goodness this whole event could be over and done with, because I have horrible foreboding about it.
it's so funny. Look, we, like you said about, we think of D-Day, we just think of World War II and D-Day often without even really thinking that much of it. But of course, there was much more to it than this inevitable success. It very much was hanging on a knife edge. And I really did appreciate that you didn't just jump right into it like the Americans perhaps wanted to jump right into the liberation of Europe in the beginning. You built up to it. And actually, a significant portion of your book, about half of your book, is spent in the preparation stage, which I really did appreciate, because you get a full sense of all the characters and where all of the different people fit into this whole project and everything else. Was it always a kind of no-brainer for you to split the book in half in that kind of sense? Or did you just happen that way because you discovered there was so much to the story you had to cover?
Well, here we have to issue a sort of spoiler alert for the readers, potential readers. If you want a book just about D-Day that starts with the soldiers in the surf and the paratroopers coming down on their sort of silken shrouds, then this book does not do that. Half of it does. But it was talking to a veteran 10 years ago who sort of said, Peter, start with the training, because getting the training right was what ensured the success on D-Day. And I took him at his word. And the more I went back looking at the American arrival in Britain, but also the big training exercises for the previous year before June 1944, took me in an unexpected direction. And I never expected the book to be as long as it is, or for half of it to be tied up with the training. But I felt that really gave the right context for those people we meet on the 6th of June.
Yeah.
And I'm very grateful for your comments. And those are many other people who say, actually, you've got it right. You need to give all the training the sort of proper shout. And I looked around, and actually no one else has really written about the preparation for D-Day.
Mm.
This has all got lost in the sort of smoke and mirrors, because everyone is fascinated by the invasion itself and all the hard work that goes in, whether it's the planning, whether it's the logistics, whether it's the rehearsals. All of that just has got lost, and it's such an important story to tell.
Yeah, absolutely it is. And I think the way this podcast works as well is that we examine not necessarily just the war, but also why the war happened. And I think the why behind D-Day is almost as fascinating as the actual act itself. Like, I love the idea, and I'm always jumping into what-if histories, but I love the idea of questioning maybe what if it hadn't succeeded, or why there was a need for it in the first place. And you say that it was inevitable there, but my question, I suppose, is what would have happened had it not actually been successful? Had they gone to all this effort, and in the end then the Germans, by whatever way, they managed to push the Allies back?
Well, counterfactual history has become quite popular, and I know, a lot of academics sort of sniff going in that direction, but actually it's a very useful way of bringing other unrehearsed arguments and little known facts to the fore that really add to our knowledge. One of the questions is, does D-Day stand a chance of being defeated? And the answer is yes, but not by the enemy you would expect. The Germans are too weak in Normandy, really, to oppose D-Day, but we don't know that. We vastly overrate the quality of the defenders. We assume they have far more tanks, and they're much better motivated and equipped than they actually are. The German army in Normandy divides into two: those in Normandy before the 6th of June, and the steely-eyed Nazi killers who arrive afterwards, who are a very different kettle of fish and very, very dangerous. But those in situ at D-Day are the remnants of the Russian front. So most of them have fought in the east, their units have been shredded, and in many cases, and we're talking two-thirds, three-quarters, have been wounded on the Eastern Front, if not in body, then in mind,
yeah.
And have come to the west to sort of recuperate and rest. to those, you've got a lot, 20-something battalions of Ukrainians, Poles, Czechs, Russians, who've been put in German uniform when they were given the option of a prison camp or working for the Germans in some capacity. And they were sold the idea that they'd be doing internal security, so keeping an eye on the French resistance. They were given cast-off weapons. They're poorly equipped. And of course, in the run-up to the invasion, they suddenly find themselves redesignated as combat commands placed behind the D-Day beaches to repel an invasion. That was never part of the cell in the first place.
Right.
And they were deeply unhappy and totally inadequately trained to do that. And then you've got lots of very young Germans being recruited into the war machine who are 16, 17, and in some cases have had barely a month of military training. So this is the German army in Normandy. It's incredibly mixed. You've got some mature people, but generally woefully ill-equipped. Mm. And the Allies are in so much better condition. So that's, you know, part of the picture that sort of suddenly unraveled before me. And the story we take away of SS units and panzers, that's just not the truth before D-Day happens.
Mm. And it's so interesting as well, because with an operation the Allies tried later in the year, Market Garden, there was the assumption when they would land with all these paratroopers in the Netherlands, there was this assumption that, oh, sure, the Dutch are mostly being guarded by like old men and young boys, and it'll be really easy. Now, I'm not at all suggesting that D-Day was going to be really easy, and I don't think anyone would have suggested that. But this image that the Allies had of the Nazi defenders being a certain way in Market Garden was almost, to an extent at least, applicable to what was awaiting them on June 6, 1944, certainly to the extent that it wasn't Nazi killers, as you say, awaiting them.
Steely-eyed Nazi killers,
yes.
Well. Yeah, I mean, this is where the understanding of modern military operations comes in, because we would not mount a military operation today with the kind of intelligence that we had available in 1944. I mean, it's just completely and totally inadequate for our purposes today. And you look back with sheer incredulity at the way the plans are put together. Yes, we know a fair amount from Bletchley Park, cracking the German Enigma and Lorentz codes as to who is where. The French resistance give us a huge amount of information at great expense on their part. But we are not nearly as aware as we need to be of the strength and motivation and locations of the German defenders. By the standards of the day, we know a huge amount, but by the standards of today, we don't know nearly enough. And the big question you always have to ask is to get inside the enemy's mind and understand their psyche. We thought they would be better motivated than they were in June 1944. Mm-hmm. We thought they would be worse motivated than they were in September 1944 at Arnhem and the whole Market Garden operation, because that's actually where some of the defenders of Normandy have gone to recuperate. Mm-hmm. And then we get caught all over again and wrong-footed in the Battle of the Bulge in December 1944, when we think the German army is spent. Mm-hmm. And they've been husbanding their reserves and are still capable of giving us a nasty surprise. So, you know, the Allied military machine and its intelligence angle, its aspects, are good by the standards of the day, but hopeless by comparison with what we would require from what we call the G2, the intelligence machinery of today.
Mm. Now, I'm worried now that I'm setting you up for a bit of a spoiler, because we've touched on the Italian campaigns in Monte Cassino, which you have a book on. We've touched on D-Day, which, of course, you've done a book on. And we've touched on The Bulge, which you have a book on. Now, is this a spoiler that there'll be a book on Market Garden in the pipeline soon?
Well, Anthony Beaver has been there, and the great Anthony, I hate to hesitate to sort of cross swords with, he and I both wrote about The Bulge at about the same time, and he is a wonderful scholar. And probably the time is not right to sort of step on his turf in Market Garden. I suspect sooner or later I will write about it. But I've never been part of the airborne fraternity. I cannot understand the mentality of throwing yourself out of a perfectly serviceable aircraft. So I might leave Market Garden on a back burner. I mean, the next book that I'm thinking of, and the title we've got squirreled away, is Fire and Steel, so that will connect with Sand and Steel and Snow and Steel about the Ardennes, and that's looking at the invasion of Germany in 1945, but both from the east as well as the west, and that will be a new departure for me, looking at Soviet, Russian and East German and Polish sources.
That's fascinating, and it also answers several of the questions I was going to ask, that this idea that you have Snow and Steel for the Bulge, now Sand and Steel for D-Day, and Fire and Steel, I think, taking in all as many elements as you can for the series, and having presented them in this way, it's almost like a sort of logical trilogy, I suppose, having these three different books. But I also think it's interesting that taking in the Eastern Front will be almost like a new departure for you, because you focused as well in the past on Montgomery and Rommel. You have a book on the two of them. So are you apprehensive or excited about examining the very destructive, very bloody, really horrific Eastern Front?
Well, I do like stretching myself. So I take a lot of people on battlefield tours and terrain studies. And I'm always asked, you know, what is my favorite battlefield? And it's the new one I'm always discovering. Mm. I've just come back from a tour taking people around Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, looking at the battles there in 1944, 1945. So there are a couple of aspects that come out of this. One is that when I wrote Monte Cassino, I learned in no uncertain terms how your main enemy isn't necessarily the opponents, in this case the Germans. In Monte Cassino, it was the weather. It's incredibly hot in the summer. It's incredibly cold in winter. People are freezing to death or dying of thirst, really. Mm. And, you know, we miss this. We think that you know, combat is all about locking horns with you know, your steely-eyed opponent who's waving a bayonet at you or firing at you. Mm. And in fact, you're at war with nature. And in D-Day, you're at war also with the English Channel. So, you know, these other books, certainly looking at Eastern Europe, we have to remember that two-thirds of the German war machine is also directed to the east. In Hitler's mind, you know, yes, the West is a big and important campaign, particularly after D-Day, but a snapshot of the German armed forces on the 6th of June, there are over 150 divisions of the German armed forces ranged along the Eastern Front, and there are only 58 divisions in the West. Mm. And that balance doesn't tilt significantly, because in Hitler's mind, the main battle for Germany's survival or victory or defeat is always going to be in the east. And the Russians get very knocked with us, very upset.
Yeah.
If we promote the fact that D-Day is as decisive as we in our minds think it is. And I was very struck yesterday when I was reporting from Portsmouth that Russia Today RT was reporting Sergei Lavrov's comments that the Allied commemorations for D-Day in Russian minds was false history, because we were overplaying the role that the Western Allies had in defeating the Hitler machine. And I felt that was sour grapes, because Putin hadn't been involved or invited to the commemoration ceremonies in the way he had been 10 years ago, and that's because of, you know, modern Russian policy.
Yes, of course.
Foreign policy. But the important point, I think, and we do miss this in the West, is that the European war is decided on the Eastern Front. Mm. 90% of the German casualties are suffered on the Eastern Front. And when the Russians launch their big attack in East Prussia to complement D-Day.
Yeah.
They don't do it on the 6th of June, they do it on the 22nd of June, because anniversaries are so important to the communist machinery. So you go in on the anniversary of the German invasion of Russia, Barbarossa, of 3 years earlier. And the Germans lose from their order of battle far more troops in 4 weeks of Operation Bagration, as it's called, than the Allies inflict German casualties in 77 days, so far more, 2.5 months of the Normandy campaign. And we miss this. This is our major effort in the West. But in the East, the relentless Russian steamroller accounts for far more Germans, and in some ways is far more influential to the eventual outcome of the war, because it's the Russians who are in Berlin, not the Americans and the Brits.
Yeah, very true, very true. And I was going to ask about that, about how I think it would be fair to say as well, and I completely agree with you about the Russian Russia Today's coverage of the event. I was looking at it myself, and typically enough with RT, I wasn't very impressed. But I think there is a kind of idea that we tend to overlook the Eastern Front, and I think if you had, say, the equivalent of some kind of Saving Private Ryan, but set in the Eastern Front, perhaps that might change. But I think for the moment, it'll be fair to say that D-Day is certainly more popular than looking at what the Russians and the Germans were doing to each other, mostly just really for American and British audiences, say, just because it concerns us more than that front does.
Yeah, I try to be objective with my history, and I have loyal Russian followers and readers, and those beyond Russia and Belarus and Ukraine and all the rest of it. And I do try and make sure that I tip my hat to what's going on in the East all the time. Because if you're Winston Churchill, you are looking to the East. And if you're Joe Stalin, you're incredibly suspicious of the Allies, who are always talking about opening a second front and never do. And so when we launch D-Day, Stalin is heard to say, you know, I wonder if it's real, and if it is, it'll probably be, you know, a couple of lifeboats depositing a platoon for a brief foray on a French beach. I mean, he has real skepticism about the level of Allied determination. And you know, the sense of scale is completely dwarfed by everything that's going on in the Eastern Front. So today, you know, you wonder whether the Western historians and Eastern historians can ever come together with a common view of what the Second World War was all about. And, I'm mortified and very upset when I fall out with my Russian opposite numbers, because it would be nice to sort of come to a sort of unified view, pay respect to the Russian soldiers who fight and die on the Eastern Front, but have them acknowledge that you know, for the West, D-Day is incredibly important. And yesterday, you know, the official Russian view seemed to be trampling over our commitment and trying to belittle what we had achieved on D-Day. And I just thought that was really, really unfortunate, because, you know, I'm in awe of what the Red Army achieved, having been so comprehensively defeated in 1941, and the way they bounced back. And those who survive are in Berlin in April 1945. I mean, it's just a stupendous achievement. But this is where politics and modern politics sort of get in the way.
Yeah.
And always will, because, you know, history is a very political beast. And you well know this in Ireland. You know, there are names and dates and places we just can't talk about without your you know, your podcast listeners getting terribly fired up about the nasty Brits.
Yeah.
And this, you know, the same is true with other subjects. And it's sad, and Anthony Beaver has tripped over this endlessly, that the Second World War is falling into that category, and the Russians have a view of false history and have made it an offence to write in terms of the Great Patriotic War, as they call it.
Yeah.
But in which Putin and his you know, leadership and colleagues don't approve. But perhaps we ought to extract ourselves from the mire of that. But it's there, and I was very struck yesterday that politics East-West rose its ugly head out of the commemoration spirit even yesterday as we were heading towards the 75th anniversary of D-Day itself.
Yeah, I think it is certainly very unfortunate, but in the spirit of extracting ourselves from the mire, let's abruptly change our course of conversation. I wanted to just unpack a question for you. I had a few listener questions for this episode, and one of them was this idea of the actual success of D-Day itself, and to what, now this is quite a difficult question to measure, but I'm sure you'll give us your best shot. To what extent was the success of D-Day due to the Allied expertise, or was it due to German incompetence? Now, I'm sure the answer exists somewhere in the middle.
Great question. If you have rehearsed every possible alternative for D-Day in the preceding year, then it gives you a very good case for saying the Allies have the best possible expertise in every respect. Mm. There is a plan B if it goes wrong. There are all sorts of ways. There's massive redundancy. We have far more planes than we need in the sky.
Sure.
We bomb the coast far more times than we need, and in fact probably fail to hit the bunkers that we should do. Almost because there are so many ships and so many aircraft in the sky, and they're worried about hitting each other.
Yeah.
It's massively insured. There's endless extra ships, battleships, endless extra landing craft. In the week before D-Day, there are 2.5 million men in southern England who are all scheduled to invade France at some stage or other, who can be brought forward or put back. So this is an exercise that's not going to fail due to lack of resources.
Sure.
Yes, German incompetence comes hugely into the equation, but I think the technical solutions that we have come up with to overcome particularly logistics challenges, like towing artificial harbours across the channel, like devising swimming tanks, like devising, it doesn't come into play on D-Day, but ultimately it's part of Operation Overlord, the fuel pipelines that are laid across the English Channel. All of these are solutions that we've come up with in the previous couple of years and are incredibly important to the ultimate success. So that's the sort of angle of Allied expertise. There's also the maturing of the army, so bottom-up solutions. How do you blast your way through hedgerows in Normandy? You weld bits onto the front of a tank, like prongs. You call it a rhino. But that idea is from a garage mechanic who's serving in the US Army and has seen the problems for himself. Yeah. So some solutions are top-down, like putting dozers on the front of tanks, making them waterproof, the armoured vehicle Royal Engineers, so engineering tanks that can carry bridges and do all sorts of things. Others are bottom-up, like this solution of blasting through hedgerows. So that's all part of the expertise. The overinsurance is there in terms of vast numbers of manpower, endless supplies. If we lose a tank, we can replace it within 24 hours. There's no end of aircraft that can replace others that have been shot down. The same with spare tank crews and pilots. The Germans can't do any of that. And they are hamstrung by Hitler. They're hamstrung by a completely overloaded chain of command.
Yeah.
You've got to go through endless levels to move a platoon from A to B over 200 metres, never mind deploy tanks. All of that works against the Germans. I think the one thing we have to take into account is there is one individual with a proven track record of bypassing German bureaucracy, and that's Erwin Rommel.
Mm.
And the one place he isn't is in his command post on the junction between the German 15th and 7th Armies on the River Seine on D-Day. He's at home in southwest Germany because the 6th of June is also his wife's birthday.
Yeah.
And there is a sense that were Rommel to have been at the handle of the fan on the morning, making decisions when he needed to, he would have probably risked Hitler's wrath, moved the tanks, moved the reinforcements when he needed to.
Absolutely.
D-Day might have been different.
Might well have been. I also thought that it was bizarre in the first place. It took next to the guts of a week, really, that he was gone for, and it just seemed like a very strange time to send him away when the Germans were certainly suspicious of the possibility of a landing coming soon. So it did seem bizarre to me that they actually allowed him leave in the first place.
I can't understand that lapse of judgment. I mean, to my mind, it's a dereliction of duty that right at the time when you are expecting the Allies to land, sometime clearly in the summer, you take... And he's not just going back for a day or two, as I say in the book. Mm. You know, if you measure out the time it takes him to drive to southwest Germany for his wife's birthday, spend time with her, he's then going to see Hitler in Bavaria. It's another few days. Coming all the way back, that's a minimum of a week away from his headquarters. And in those days, you couldn't fly because the Allies ruled the sky. And if you went by train, there's a fair chance your train might be targeted by fighter bombers or the rails disrupted. So it's a major decision to leave your headquarters. Mm. And the trouble is his deputy, Hans Speidel, who's later a senior NATO commander, is very bureaucratic and ponderous. And he later spins the web that he's part of the anti-Hitler Stauffenberg conspiracy. So he's holding back from reacting to the invasion. That's nonsense. That doesn't accord with the facts. In fact, the night before, he's had a dinner party, a rather convivial gathering. And if anything, the reason why he doesn't make decisions or react terribly well is because he's got a headache. he's got a hangover. I firmly believe it's not much more than that. When Rommel returns with his driver and his chief staff officer and his ADC, they go into his headquarters at La Roche-Guyon. There is Speidel, his army group chief of staff, listening to a Wagner opera. And the driver says, "Yeah, for goodness sake, you know, Herr General, what, the invasion has started. What are you doing?" My dear boy, you know, you think by listening to Wagner is going to stop the invasion or alter the course of history? What planet do these guys live on?
Yeah, oh, I know. Now, it's funny because we touch on the kind of unreal aspects of that, but of course the men who were about to land faced a terrible challenge. I just wanted to ask you if you wouldn't mind the different beaches that were being landed at. So you had Omaha, Utah, Gold, Juneau, and Sword, with different dispositions of nationalities tied up in that. If you had to pick one of those beaches to land on yourself, based on how I supposedly comparatively easy it would have been to the other ones, which one would you have chosen and why?
Well, first, can I have a TARDIS so I can get there without the seasickness, because I'm never very good with the waves. And, you know, one of the mass memories that everybody communicates to me is this, you know, the greatest mass case of seasickness known to mankind that everyone seems to experience. No one seems to be immune from examining their breakfast or last night's supper on that journey across the channel. So I'd rather like to avoid that, turn up on one of the beaches in a TARDIS, and preferably not be shot in the first 5 seconds from which I view the beach. Any of them would have been interesting. The first beach I ever encountered was Sword Beach, which was a traditional beach. There are the concrete obstacles still on it, if you knew where to look. Mm. And there I met Piper Bill Millin, the personal piper of Lord Lovett, who was the dashing brigade commander of the four battalions of British commandos. Now, Millin was the age when I met him that I am now, and he gave me a word picture of what it was like. He said, I strode down the ramp of my landing craft, and the first thing that happened, I stepped into the channel. I was wearing my kilt, and as is traditional, nothing underneath. And the sheer cold of the English Channel just played havoc with my anatomy. But I had to carry on playing the pipes. And he said that was more of a challenge, focusing on that, than worrying about being shot at, and particularly as the Brigadier was just in front of me and kept turning around looking at me. So he had to carry on playing the pipes.
Wow.
You know, and he then strode up and down the shore, and he said, you know, I couldn't take cover. And he said, interestingly, the effect was, you know, some of the other commandos started to run for cover and make themselves as small as possible. I couldn't do that. And when they looked around and saw me striding up and down the sands, that gave them courage to come up out of their little cubby holes and move forward. And it underlines the point that music in war, all the way through the centuries, through history, is incredibly important. And that's why. Because, you know, in times gone by, it's acted as instructions, pipes and drums and all the rest of it. But on the 6th of June 1944, it's a great morale booster. And when you turn around and you look at the musician, whether it's a bugler or in this case a piper, and realize that he's not taking cover, you certainly can't.
Yeah.
It does act. It's a tiny piece in a jigsaw, but it explains why people sort of get up and carry on. And then finally, Bill Millin, you know, on Sword Beach in 1975, he said a bit later on, we captured a German sniper and he was brought to me. And he said to me through the interpreter, I had you in my sights, you know. And Millin said, gosh, you know, why am I alive now? Why didn't you kill me? And the German sniper looked at him and he said, but you're mad. You're totally bonkers. You were always out in front of your men playing that stupid instrument. And I realized that you were clearly certifiable and there's no point in wasting a bullet on someone like you.
Wow.
So, I, any of the beaches you could have put me on. And I have wonderful stories from all of them. I'd love to have seen Brigadier General Theodore Roosevelt on Utah Beach, any of the heroes on Omaha. But the first person I met was Bill Millin, and I'd love to have walked those few moments with him when he landed on Sword Beach on D-Day.
Fascinating, yeah. But I think something that really gripped me in your book was this image of the Germans preparing, to the best of their abilities anyway, their Atlantic Wall, which of course Hitler built up and his propagandists built up as this impregnable fortress. But of course it was very much, it left a lot to be desired, let's just say. Now, to this day, as we've said, there is still remnants of that wall left over, and there's still, you can still visit portions of that. How important do you think it is that those pillboxes, those bunkers, etc., are preserved?
Incredibly important. I mean, it's significant, I think, that the French government have yet to list them, or just beginning to start to in one or two locations, in the way that we would slap a sort of heritage order on any remains from the 1940s along the English coast, or preserve a battlefield.
Sure.
That hasn't happened in Normandy. It's beginning to. But I think that's what makes the battle, D-Day itself, the Battle of Normandy, the French coast, so interesting to visit, because there are so many of these relics from the 1940s there. And, of course, threaded together, the Germans called all of this the Atlantic Wall. It stretches all the way from Normandy right down to the border with Spain and along the south of France. But, of course, the moment you call something the Atlantic Wall, it's a propaganda name.
Yeah.
And that's to deter the Allies. And to a certain extent, it does the job, because it's thickest around Calais and it deters us from landing there. So it does canalize us and limit our options. And to that extent, you know, part of the aim of it is successful. But the moment you call it the Atlantic Wall and that message goes back to Berlin, Hitler begins to believe his own propaganda. He thinks of a wall.
Yeah.
Now, this is bonkers, because what's happened in 1940 is the French have come up with the Maginot Line. They believe it's impregnable, and they think of a line, a long First World War-type series of defences that are impregnable. The Germans prove that that's myth and break through. But here we are all over again, and Hitler thinking in terms of a stone castle wall, which it isn't. And in his mind, that's what he's thinking. He never comes to Normandy, he never inspects it. And so all he ever sees are the propaganda pictures. And of course, Rommel knows it's a complete and total myth. Really interesting to reflect that Omaha Beach, you know, the dreaded Omaha Beach, 5 miles of a sort of concave-shaped beach with cliffs, had the Germans landed there on the 6th of June 1943, had the Allies landed there on the 6th of June 1943, the Germans wouldn't have had a bucket and spade with which to oppose them.
Yeah.
Nothing there. And the Atlantic Wall is built in iterations. And there's a bit here and a bit there, and then when there's some more resources or money or personnel, then you get the thing being built in dribs and drabs. And that's the trouble. It's one of the reasons why it's not effective. And it never can be, because it's spread over too wide an area.
Yeah, yeah. It's just so fascinating that even to this day, I think most of us assume that the Germans were steely-eyed killers, as you say, and they were well prepared. But at some points, it was just literally like a ditch was the extent of the wall in that area, or a bit of unrolled barbed wire and everything. And looking, because of course you've done a book before on Montgomery and Rommel, so you know full well the impact Rommel has had in isolation. But just to see him here, just in the D-Day campaign itself, how he was horrified by how completely inadequate the preparations were, and how he went above and beyond to the best of his abilities to get Germans actually defending and get discipline back up and all this kind of thing. How, having looked at the likes of Rommel, the likes of Montgomery, how much of an impact do you think, and you've answered this in a sense already, but how much of an impact do you think Rommel could have had in the German defence if he'd stuck around for longer, if he hadn't been forced to commit suicide? And I think it was in July, shortly after the Operation Valkyrie failed.
Yeah, I mean, Rommel's incredibly important to our understanding of Normandy, partly because of the German expectations of what they might achieve with him at the helm, and partly because, you know, we know of his, you know, very tragic demise. That would, of course, play out in the Battle of the Bulge, about which I've also written, because Rommel would without doubt have been a leading light in the Battle of the Bulge, due to his reputation. And he, of course, is the reason why the Bulge is fought when it is, where it is, because it's replicating his lightning advance through the Ardennes of 1940.
Sure.
And that's absolutely the reason why he hit the lights on it, because Rommel, before he takes over 7th Panzer Division in February 1940, has been in charge of Hitler's personal bodyguard. And so Rommel is a name known to Hitler already in 1940. Mm. And so of all the armies, all the divisions plunging into France that first time, Rommel's is one of the major units that he follows. And so the reason for the Battle of the Bulge, partly in 1944, is to replicate Rommel's success of 4 years earlier. So Rommel's incredibly important, but the hinterland of both Rommel and Montgomery in North Africa is really important to our understanding of the German defences in Normandy and the battle, because long defensive lines are impossible in a North African desert. And that is all about manoeuvre and deception. Deceive that your allies are your opponents, that you'll come here and work your way around. And both are doing the same to each other. Alamein is partly a victory of deception, but Rommel has done the same much earlier on in the Libyan desert. And so the idea you can't have long lines of fixed defences, they will never hold out forever, is something that both commanders realise. And that's Rommel's tragedy, that he's not there from day one to fence with Montgomery. But I assess at the end of the day, they're quite different people. They have several duels with each other on the same battlefields, but Montgomery understands logistics. He's been to all the higher schools of war, and he's good at handling armies and army groups, although he never understands working alongside allies. Rommel, on the other hand, Rommel is a great tactician, and I don't think he ever breaks out of that mentality of handling a company or a battalion, say, no more than perhaps 1,000 men. And he always wants to be at the front. And, yeah, of course, that's his undoing. That's why he's shot up in his staff car on the 17th of July, visiting his men at the front. Montgomery visits out of combat, but he's always at his command post at the centre of the fan, understanding what's going on. Rommel's instinct is always to go forward. And we love that, you know, the smell of grape shot. But that's not the place of the guy at the top.
Mm.
So they are different. And it's the undoing of Rommel, and it's probably the making of Montgomery. But they're past battlefields. They're incredibly important to understanding the way they fight in Normandy.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. Well, we're getting near the end of our talk today, but I wanted to ask, because something which really struck me about a book the size of yours was the size of its bibliography as well. And I just wanted to know if there was maybe one primary source and maybe one secondary source that really stood out to you as kind of like your favorite.
Well, that's a very good question. The bibliography, you make reference to that. I trimmed that down originally. That's probably 20% of the original bibliography, but the book was already too long, so I trimmed the 70-page bibliography down to what you have in the book.
Wow.
There's just so much there, and so many sort of sources that I raided. I was so behind with writing the book, I took myself off to Croatia for 18 months to write it in complete and total seclusion. And I took the 100 best books I wanted with me, a lot on Kindle, electronic books, and then a lot I raided on the internet. So I direct people to one great source, which was the BBC Wartime Memories Project. Because I think it was the 50th anniversary of D-Day, they started to collect an awful lot of public memories. And there are 20,000-30,000 memories that people wrote in with. And these are all archived online. And, you know, the cross-referencing isn't great, but the rich vein of stories that I was able to draw on and through then contact some of the original eyewitnesses was completely invaluable. And they had never really sort of been exploited. Alongside, I layered, you know, my 1,000 interviews. So that, you know, that was a huge step forward. And I then looked at Cornelius Ryan's own notes, and they're in the Ohio State University at Athens, in the United States. And of course, he only used a tiny fraction of all the interviews that he conducted and the notes he took. And so there was a real treasure trove there. One thing I tried to do, of course, was make sure that the Germans were fairly represented and not excluded or minimized. So actually tracking down German sources was less challenging than I thought. And a lot of Germans had migrated to the United States having been prisoners of war there. And so there was a rich vein of German experiences in local state archives in the United States. So in terms of sort of, you know, primary sources, that was a really, really rich vein. In terms of secondary sources, there are so many large, good recent books about Normandy, and whether we're talking sort of, you know, Max Hastings or John Keegan, Six Armies in Normandy, Stephen Ambrose, Rick Atkinson, Anthony Beaver, to name three, have just written very good books. There's a very good campaign history by my wonderful fellow warrior in arms or scribe, James Holland, who's written Normandy 44, which is about the whole campaign. I must stress I only need the first 24 hours, and I stop at midnight on D-Day. But I probably sort of focus on the interviews conducted by American military historians with the top German commanders that were undertaken in the late 1940s, when all these guys were still alive. And essentially, the U.S. Army wanted to know how the Germans functioned in battle and why and how they won or functioned and were defeated, because we might need to do the same against the Russians in World War III at some stage in the Cold War. So there were lots of pertinent military questions that they were asking the senior commanders behind D-Day at every level, and they were all captured and willing to offer up their answers, you know, while they were still combat mentors and only recently out of uniform. Now, you've got to qualify that by saying that, you know, they were amenable to the United States Army because they thought they would have better conditions. Some were worried about being charged with war crimes. But these are fresh interviews. They're conducted within recent memory, sometimes with access to the archives and official German records. And they are the ETHINT series, E-T-H-I-N-T. And they're in various books. A lot are online now, and they're in the U.S. National Archives in Maryland as well. So that's a great resource. I call them a sort of secondary source, really, because they've been written up and presented and analyzed in various books. But they're well worth going to, because it does give you the insight into what the German commanders were thinking. And as you know, so many history books, as you're well aware, we write them from our own comfortable point of view.
Sure.
Much of the First World War is written purely from the English-speaking point of view. We know much less about the Germans. We're in danger with the Second World War of writing from the English-speaking point of view. And I needed to balance that by making sure that the Germans had a fair shout to explain what was going on the other side of the hill. So that was why that source I'm drawing your attention to, because I found it particularly valuable.
Very good. Thank you for that. That explanation.
Monster answer, yeah,
almost as comprehensive as the bibliography itself with that answer. So thank you very much for that. I think, as a final word, Peter, I want to ask you a question that sounds simple enough, but in fact is very difficult. 75 years to the day that D-Day was launched, after so many years of preparation, it still, of course, captures the imagination of enthusiasts and experts like yourself alike. If you could pick a single thing that you think has made D-Day the most famous Allied act since, what do you think that one thing would be?
Gosh, that's an interesting question. I mean, it has become shorthand for the Second World War in Europe. So if there's one day that probably school kids are now taught in association with World War II, it's D-Day. The scale is what leaps out at you. The sheer enormity of the number of ships and aircraft, never mind the sort of manpower. I think when I was in Portsmouth yesterday, there was a ship chartered by the Royal British Legion containing 300 veterans, which sailed past me across the English Channel, escorted by warships, and a Spitfire flew overhead. And it brought a lump to the throat and moist eyes, because it took you back to that moment. I don't think it's any one thing. It's a combination of the resources. And
sure,
seeing it last night, seeing this ship, merchant ship that represented all the civilian ships that have been commandeered and converted into landing ships and assault ships, and then a Royal Naval frigate and a Canadian frigate escorting it, that to me sort of summed up a microcosm, a piece of the jigsaw puzzle of the fleet going across. And a veteran told me he remembered being in the Solent on the 5th of June 1944. He said you could have walked from Portsmouth on the English side across the deck of every ship to the Isle of Wight on the other side without getting your feet wet.
Wow. So
there's an image of all the shipping. And someone else had told me how the sky darkened and you struggled to see the sky or the clouds for the sheer number of aircraft flying overhead. And that sort of Spitfire and that sigh of the Merlin engine summed that up for me. So not one thing, the opposite, the sheer scale of everything. And I just got a hint of that yesterday, that for a moment brought a huge lump to my throat. And, it was a privilege to be there. And I felt something from the past at that moment.
Well, it was a privilege to be there, and it's been a privilege to have you on, Peter. So thank you so much for joining us.
Zach, it's been a huge pleasure, and I hope we can do this again sometime.
Absolutely, absolutely. And if, as a last word, if someone would wish to get your very large, very excellent book, where would be the best place to go?
Well, I know that you are going to offer a giveaway copy signed by the author. But available in all good bookstores, as we say, and the usual mail order outlets. It's got a very, very wide distribution. As you go online, you'll see two different covers. That's because there's a US edition as well as a United Kingdom edition. It's also available as an ebook, Kindle, or whatever, so you can download that. And I think there's an audiobook probably in the wings as well. So it's there in every possible dimension. every bookstore will see it because it's readily available through Penguin Random House or Oxford University Press. And they distribute all over the world. And who knows, it probably in several different languages. I know we're talking about different foreign language editions as I speak.
Excellent. That's great to hear. So there should be no difficulty at all in finding it. That's fantastic.
Thank you. It's been great talking about it. D-Day is my tribute to these guys, and I have been, they've been with me for the years I've been writing the book, always tapping me on the shoulder to, you know, metaphorically remember this story and not exclude that. And I was very sad when I wrote the last words to the book, because it's been part of my life and they've been part of my life for so long. So I hope I've done them proud.
I think it's fairly safe to say that you have, Peter. I think it's a credit to you. It's a credit to the historiography of the event. And I'm so privileged to have had you on to talk about it. So thanks very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Zach.
Okay. So I hope you enjoyed that interview, guys. I myself really did enjoy it. And thanks again to Peter Cadigadams for coming on. Of course, a brief reminder, if you have forgotten after that long interview there, you can get this book of Peter's for free. As he says in this episode, you can get a free signed copy that he is giving away. To be in with a chance of winning that, all you have to do is go onto Twitter or Facebook and share, like, comment, etc., and spread the word of this competition. Spread the word of this book and get in with the spirit of this fantastic anniversary by remembering the men that sacrificed so much for us 75 years ago. That's it, guys. That is the interview. That is the episode. Thank you for listening. Thank you to Peter Cadigadams once again. And I'll be seeing you all soon.